Well, growing up on a farm, we had plenty of wide open space in our yard for vehicles and machinery to operate. And all that open space meant lots and lots and lots of grass, which meant lots and lots and lots of mowing. Now, once I was old enough to work, I joined in that collective family effort to mow all the grass. But at that younger age, I didn't exactly get to do the fun part. My earliest tasks were moving the gutters out of the way, picking up rocks and sticks, and taking a scissors and trimming long grass along the edges. Now, I eventually got to graduate to the push mower, which was more fun to be sure. It was actually mowing, but it was so physically taxing, and it cut such a narrow line of grass. But then, when I was in middle school, I reached the magical point in every farm kid's life when I graduated to the big mow, riding mower. Yeah, that's right. Now, in retrospect, the big mow was not actually very big at all. It was a small riding lawn mower with just three wheels and just two speeds, slow and slower. And it probably only cut like 6 inches wider than the push mower. But nevertheless, this was a big deal for me. And so my father, the master of mowing, he brought me, his young grass chopper, out to the big mow. And he taught me how to start it, showed me the controls, and he warned me, if you are ever unsure of what to do, the first thing you gotta do is stop. But I think at that point, my soda-flooded preteen brain was a little too excited to really listen, so I just kind of hopped on and got started. It was a blast, steering, riding, humming to myself, feeling that nearly non-existent June breeze that comes from only going 3 miles an hour. Perfect. 20 minutes in, I felt like I'd really gotten the hand of it. And then I took a corner a little too sharp, and I shaved a few flowers out of the garden bed. Oops. And then maybe I got a little distracted, and I caught the edge of the grill, and I almost tipped it over, but I didn't. So no harm, no foul, right? Well then, just as I began a new section of grass near the house, I saw before me, laying right in my path, a fist-sized rock. You see, we had this dog that would carry rocks around in her mouth, and then she would just drop them all over the yard. And so there it was, this big rock just waiting to scrape up the mower blades. I panicked. What do I do? Gosh, I can't run it over. Dad's going to be so upset. And it felt like this was all happening in an instant, right? Although reality is that it was going at 3 miles an hour, and I had plenty of time. But in that panic, I couldn't think of what to do, and so right before the rack, I finally just grabbed the wheel and I yanked hard to the left. The mower jerked in that direction and avoided the rock, but then immediately struck into the side of the house. I leapt off the mower, still panicking, and there it sat, wheels still grinding down into the dirt as the bright red paint of the mower's front started marking up the pristine white house siding. My dad heard the commotion, ran up, and he made the mower stop. He turned it off, and needless to say, at that point, I wasn't so sure if I was ready for the big mow after all. Well, something I've learned over the years is that these moments, these complicated moments in the master and apprentice process, are a universal experience. There's no amount of watch and learn or raw talent that can avoid it. Anybody taking on a new task just kind of has to go through the bumpy process to learn the ropes and make their mistakes. Like, thank goodness driver's ed teachers have their own little brake pedal on that other side of the car, right? But in the process of making our mistakes, as we learn, we can sometimes grow reluctant, tentative, fearful, overly cautious about stepping up, especially when we have watched someone else before us accomplish that task with all this skill and confidence that we only wish we could have. Elisha's story of apprenticeship is no exception. In today's passage, we witnessed him sticking ever so closely to Elijah's side, even when he was repeatedly instructed to stop. Maybe he was caught in the panic of this transitional moment, and he needed his master's presence. Sure didn't seem like he was ready for this day to come. And why would he be, right? Just a short time prior to this moment, Elisha, similar to my little story, he was a farm kid working along his family. And in just a couple short chapters, God determined that Elijah was going to have a new successor, and it would be him. And he was whisked away to witness these final great acts of the great prophet. Elijah had just returned from his own wilderness journey, refreshed and renewed by the still small voice of God. And he rid the kingdom of Israel and Judah from their wicked rulers. He did all of that. But then immediately following this massive shift in power structure, Elijah's ministry was apparently complete. It was time for him to go, and for Elisha to apparently pick right up where he left off. No training manual, no guidebook, no practice runs, just boom. You are now God's chosen prophet. Yikes. It may have been very tempting in that moment for Elisha to maybe take a page out of the book of Jonah and respond to God's call by running away in the very opposite direction. But he didn't do that. Despite whatever doubts or anxieties befell him, Elisha stayed the course. And in the end, he picked up the mantle. If we look carefully at this story, I think we see a couple details of just how he got there. The first thing to notice is that with each phase of the journey, they were being met by these other prophets, right? And in those days, there were these companies or schools of prophets, and they were often being taught and raised under a particular leader. In the case of this story, these might have been prophets all in the school of Elijah. And with Elisha being named his successor as this rural nobody that showed up out of nowhere, they may have been harboring some vengefully jealous feelings, having been a part of that school for years and years. Perhaps this is why that interaction with Elisha seems a bit cold or harsh, almost like they're mocking him or bullying him. But how did Elisha respond to those negative voices? He addressed them, but he also set them aside. He paid as little attention as he could so as to keep his focus on the task at hand and avoid getting bogged down by all the chatter. Makes me think of a little song lyric that Pastor Bill used to share with me before he left, which went, "Don't worry what the bitter hearts are gonna say." As you face new transitions and opportunities, as you anticipate taking on a new role, you are bound to hear the negative voices, whether it's the skeptics of those around you, or if it's the voices in your own head. I think many of us have a very powerful inner critic that can be a relentless source of self-doubt and shame, drowning us in the what-ifs that can keep us from ever moving forward. Or maybe you do have oppositional people in your life that are projecting their own issues into your life and bogging down the progress you're trying to make. But to heed God's call placed on our lives, we need to rein those voices in. Now, that doesn't mean shielding yourself from critique or ignoring wise words of caution, by no means. But we do need not let the words of bitter hearts impede what God is calling us to do. The next detail we ought to notice comes as the two of them cross the Jordan River into the wilderness, where Elijah invites Elisha to ask him what he can do. And in a moment of boldness, Elisha asks for a double portion of Elijah's spirit to fall upon him. Now here, I think it's important to make a clarification that when he's making this ask, he's not demanding that he become twice the prophet Elijah ever was. That would be incredibly presumptuous. We should understand this through the ancient Hebrew culture, which worked within this honor system of firstborn in the family. Which, whenever there was a firstborn, it was understood that they were going to receive a double portion of their inheritance, whereas all subsequent siblings got a single portion. So when he's making this ask, Elisha's essentially asking that he could be Elijah's prophetic firstborn to receive twice the spirit he'd normally inherit. He asks for this relationship not to just be master and apprentice, but family, and for that to manifest in a special blessing so that he actually has what he needs to go from there. And so I wonder how, too, you can be bold in what you ask for as you discern what you need to heed God's call for your life. I think sometimes we get caught up in a little bit of that kind of Midwestern-y culture where we're caught up in the fear that if we ask for something, it means we're being needy or pushy or selfish. But frankly, that's absurd. We need to ask for things. You know why? Because we have needs. It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a true thing about being a human. You all have needs. And you yourself cannot meet many of those needs by yourself. So ask. Please. Ask for what you need. If you have a neat idea for our church's ministry, or maybe you're going to kind of take over a portion of the ministry here, but you need leadership or guidance or materials or resources, ask for it. And then there's the other end of the spectrum. If you have been absolutely swamped with busyness, and you're starting to notice that it is taking a toll on your mental or physical health, and you just need a rest or a break, please ask for it. You'd be amazed how often a willingness to ask is met with respect and appreciation. And if it's not, that's not on you. That's on them. Finally, let's stop and consider the final moments of 2 Kings 2, where Elijah has been whisked up into heaven by chariots of fire, and there stands Elisha, out in the wilderness, alone across the Jordan, forcefully separated from his master. He tears at his robes, a classic biblical sign of mourning, distress, anger, fear, and sadness. He has been left there to go his own way, and he is unsure if he's been granted the spirit he needs. And in that moment, he could give up. I'm reminded again of song lyrics, this time from Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, where it says, "I should have stayed on the farm. I should have listened to my old man. I'm going back to my plow." I wonder how many of those words were ringing in Elisha's head in that moment. But he doesn't do it. He finds the courage somewhere deep down to pick up the mantle and take the next step. Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? As the waters separate, his question is overwhelmingly answered. God is here. God is with you. God has a calling for your life, though you may feel lost. God will equip you, though you may feel unworthy. God is making a way for you, though there seems to be no way. But sometimes we'll never see it, or we'll miss it entirely, if we don't find that ounce of courage to just pick up the mantle and take the next step. Friends, this church has been utterly blessed with the gifts and service and leadership of so many Elijahs in the past, boldly taking action, speaking truth, and working in service to the Lord. I'm especially mindful of our dear brother, Dr. Michael Eldridge. After a service Friday, just hearing all these stories of the ways in which he was a force of leadership and of spiritual growth in this community for years and years. And as we continue to mourn his passing and the passing of others, it can be hard to look ahead and wonder what the future might hold without the presence of people like that. The folks whose shoes we feel we could never fill. But I tell you this. I look out into this room today, and I see an entire congregation of Elishas. Every single one of you is called by God to shut out the harmful voices, to ask for what you need, and to discern how you can pick up the mantle and take your next step. God is here with you and will meet your courage with blessing. I think you're all ready for the big mo. Amen.